from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's our week in review, and what a week it was, with Washington in turmoil over President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey.
Donald Trump does not want anyone near him with an investigatory powers about his connection to his campaign and ties to Russia.
Also today, after 10 years in prison, including 2 years in solitary confinement, Kyle Gathers will graduate from college this weekend. We'll hear his story. And actor Cherry Jones, who launched her theater career in Cambridge, comes back to Boston to be honored. Among her many roles, she plays the radical feminist professor on Transparent.
Are you going to come study with me, the big bad dyke?
Well, I don't really teach. I like to talk about things I care about to people who are ready.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review, starting with, what else, the firing of FBI Director James Comey and response from members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. In an interview yesterday with NBC News, President Trump justified Comey's firing this way.
He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that.
But here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who told us this week what she and many of her fellow Democrats believe is the real reason Trump fired Comey.
The reasoning is laughable. The truth is obvious. Donald Trump does not want anyone near him with an investigatory powers about his connection to his campaign and ties to Russia.
And Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton called the Comey firing part of a rapidly escalating crisis.
I think it is a national crisis, and I think it's quickly becoming a constitutional crisis because of the abuses of power that Trump and the executive branch are taking to cover up these crimes. But I don't think that anybody's fooled. You know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And there is so much smoke here, it seems like a massive bonfire.
All right, joining us now to talk about all this and the rest of the week's news, Michael Curry. He's former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. And Michael, welcome back to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Glad to be back.
Also with us this week is Jennifer Nasur. She's the former chairwoman of the Massachusetts Republican Party and of counsel to Rubin and Rudman. Jennifer, great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
So let's dive right into this enormous story that's dominating the news. There have been conflicting statements from the Trump administration about why President Trump decided to fire Comey. A White House statement on Tuesday said that it was the president was acting on the recommendations of the Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Assistant Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. But then President Trump made it clear that, no, he did this because he wanted to and he was going to do it anyway. Michael Curry, let me start with you. What do you make of the firing of James Comey?
Well, I mean, it's troubling. I think you're hearing a chorus of folks, including some Republicans, that feel like this was bad timing. It wasn't a process that made sense. It was disrespectful to Comey and his many years of service. And it really undermines what we all are looking for, which is a process that it can investigate whether Russia had some tampering with maybe some activity by members of the Trump campaign, and that Comey's being there, at least from all perceptions. I mean, he was messing up, if you want to look at it that way, to Republicans and Democrats in terms of how he handled it. He was apolitical in some sense. And folks
you
wanted...
mean he was an equal opportunity messer?
Exactly.
Yeah, gotcha.
So folks wanted this investigation to play out. And what it's been out of the Trump administration is like the bad news bears of politics and governing. Folks aren't on the same page. It's impulsive. It's reactive. And it's concerning for all of us.
Yeah. Jennifer Nasser, I'd love to get your response as well.
So... you know, it would be interesting if we could go back 6 months and we could change the election outcome and see if it was Hillary Clinton that was elected and what James Comey's fate would have been. I think 6 months ago, Democrats would have said, get rid of him immediately. Now it's the Republicans getting rid of him. So I think if you look on it, at it, you know, on a fair basis of he's an equal opportunity pain in the butt, right, then everyone wanted to get rid of him. I think the biggest problem for the Trump administration is this. Number one, no one's on the same page. He let his senior staffers know an hour before it happened. Sean Spicer didn't even know. He didn't have time to prepare for this. He had a staff meeting behind a bunch of hedges and came out to a bunch of press standing
there. This is Sean Spicer, I mean, who literally said, turn off the lights, I'll talk to you, but not on TV. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so he was caught basically, you know, with his pants down. Not literally, but I mean, he's behind the hedges and he this is the information he has. So I think that, you know, the optics of this, the appearance of it, the timing, Trump is not masterful at any of that. And I think most we are very used to our leaders being masterful, being very methodical, and Trump lacks the capacity to be methodical.
Well, let's listen to a little bit from a conversation we had this week with Senator Elizabeth Warren, a little more of that. We heard her in the opening of this segment. But here's what she said about calling for that this raises the need for a special prosecutor. Here's a little bit of what she said.
We must have a special prosecutor here. And we've got to have someone who is independent, who has got the resources, who has got the authority to get to the bottom of this. Good, bad, or indifferent, whatever is the truth here, we need a special prosecutor to get the truth out there. And everyone should care about that.
So, Jennifer, I want to come back to you to respond to Senator Warren, because, I mean, a moment ago you were talking about confusion and sort of what amounts to bad optics. And I take your point there. Senator Warren is talking about something, and a lot of the Democrats, a lot more serious, right? She's talking about this was an effort to derail an investigation that was getting too close to the president. Do you buy that?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think Trump had his issues with Comey. I think, again, both parties had their issues with Comey. I think Comey's head was on the chopping block going back to October, September, October, and it didn't matter who was going to be the president. So I think past that, though, yes, a special investigator should be appointed. There should be someone else. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. I mean, maybe I don't know if, you know, the president, I'm not on the phone with him. But I mean, I think Republicans agree that a special prosecutor should be in place here.
Although, Michael Curry, not very many Republicans in Washington yet agree with that. Do you think they're going to get there, given the turmoil that's coming out of there?
I think they have no choice. I think, you know, what we've been seeing play out, it plays out in politics in general sometimes, but you'll see what I call politicrits, right, is that the notion that it doesn't apply that now the shoe's on the other foot. The reality is that they would have called for a special prosecutor if this were a Democrat and there were the same circumstances. I think it'll eventually play out that there's a lack of trust in this administration. There's no truth coming out of this administration. It's lots of spin. And they're going to say, you know what, it is in the best interest of the country that we ask for a special prosecutor. I think, you know, people and I've hung out with, and I know the Boston FBI very well. When you get to the rank and file FBI agents, I think people will try to do the right thing. But we know how politics works. Politics can sometimes have a chilling effect on how people do the right thing. Hmm. And the fervor, the forcefulness with which they conduct an investigation. So I think a special prosecutor is necessary, and I think we will eventually get a consensus among Democrats and Republicans to get there.
You know, all of this happens with a pretty ambitious agenda in Washington on the part of Republicans in Congress. They're talking about tax reform. Of course, there's the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. I'd love to ask you both. Jennifer, I'll start with you. I mean, what does this do, this turmoil that we're seeing right now, to essentially the work of the people and the agenda in Congress?
So first of all, let's go back to 2010. There's been turmoil in Congress since, you know, there has been a seismic shift in the parties where the Republicans have had this big pull to the right from the Tea Party back then, and the Democrats have had this big pull to the left. And I think the more that we are romanticizing the fact of people getting on TV and fighting and arguing, and of course, like if I take Michael in a headlock and I slam him down to the ground,
and I believe you could do that,
your ratings are going to be amazing, right?
But, I wouldn't let it happen, Michael. That's my job.
But
here.
I mean, you know, he seems like a nice guy, yeah. And so you know, we have friends in common, and that's not going to happen. Yeah. And so unfortunately, you know, the theatrics of politics has really moved the country, and yeah. It's very unfortunate because I think that it is not something that just happened in 2017 with this Congress and this administration. It is something that has been brewing for a while.
Yeah. Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we're a divided country and we're a divided Congress, right? And quite frankly, I'm troubled by where we are. I think most of us who turn on the television, and many of us don't turn on the television and watch the news anymore because it creates this anxiety. We need to move some things forward. We need a transportation infrastructure bill that will put people to work and create, you know, fix roads and bridges. We need we may disagree on what tax changes we need, but there may be some need to look at what those are. And quite frankly, there's an ideological difference that's between the parties, but within the party. When I say the party, I'm talking about the Republican Party, the far right, who believe that we should not have Medicaid expansion, that we should get government out of health care. And then you have some moderate Republicans like Collins, who believes that there's a role that we play to make
Susan Collins, right, yeah.
To make sure that people are covered. So I think that what we're seeing is we're in a bottleneck where we can't get anything done because there's such an ideological divide in the nation and down in D.C.
And, you know, that is absolutely such an amazing point, Michael, because I've had this conversation with members of Congress because it really boggles my mind. I mean, the Republican Party right now, I mean, Democrats have their own issues. But speaking from the Republican perspective, we are so spread out over different levels. Why a tax reform bill would bring the party together, and it would get us a lot of the moderate Democrats that want to move some good policy forward. Infrastructure, everyone agrees with it. I mean, this gets people back to work. It puts money into the economy. Who doesn't love that? And they just keep getting bogged down in the weeds on these other matters that are just causing more friction.
And just to add to that, I think Trump is so impulsive. I mean, I would really love to take a poll of Republicans off air, just sit down and talk to them, because I think even if you voted for him, you can tell that he's impulsive, he's not consistent, and quite frankly, he brings that sort of real estate shadiness to governing. And I think that's the best way to describe it, which is basically it's not about the truth, it's about winning. And it's about influencing the outcome by any means necessary. That should trouble us all as Americans. And I quite frankly am troubled every time I turn on the television and listen to him or watch a tweet.
Well, speaking of the legislative agenda, and you both made reference to, or I guess you did, Michael, to health care. I want to talk about what happened on Sunday. President Obama was in Boston to receive the Profile and Courage Award from the Kennedy family, and he used his speech at the Kennedy Library to really sort of weigh back into the political fray, really for the first time since leaving office. He defended the Affordable Care Act, said it took courage for lawmakers to pass it back in 2009, and encouraged lawmakers today to show a bit of courage of their own. Here's a bit of what he said.
I hope that current members of Congress recall that it actually doesn't take a lot of courage to aid those who are already powerful, already comfortable, already influential, but it does require some courage to champion the vulnerable and the sick and the infirm.
Michael, I'll start with you on this one. President Obama is still very careful. He didn't mention Trump by name. He wasn't really sort of in full campaign mode. But there he was taking a stand on a big issue in Washington. What did you think of the president sort of weighing back in to the political debate?
One, I'm a fan of President Obama's, and I wish he had come out sooner. But I appreciate that he took some time away for he and his family. We need his voice. I think, quite frankly, the misrepresentation of the ACA. The ACA is not perfect. Like any other major piece of legislation, whether it's state or federal, it has flaws. It needs to be fixed. But the reality is millions of Americans, and I will say this as an NAACP-er, many of them people of color, went from going to the ER to get their primary care to having a primary care doctor, to diagnosing that diabetes and that cancer sooner in order to have a chance to live and live longer and raise a family. So he needs to tell that story, because I think people get bogged down in whether the ACA is good, which the polls say, but the Obamacare is bad, when they're really the same thing. He needs to come out and say, you know what, this was a good piece of legislation that needs to be fixed. But quite frankly, we have a party that's really running a campaign against something that is good for people, good for America.
Yeah. Jennifer, I mean, I guess one of the things that the president is contending with is this belief in the important principle that there's only one president at a time. So it seems like he's moving carefully back into this debate, still not mentioning Trump by name, not wanting to get his hands too dirty in it. What did you see on Sunday?
I mean, not surprised that he mentioned it. He brought it up. This is his signature piece of legislation. And of course, this is his baby. So he's going to be a little bit more protective over this. I don't know how much it matters, because Republicans, if we go back to 2010 when Scott Brown was elected, he was elected in Massachusetts off of being the 41st vote in the Senate against Obamacare. And so I don't know how much the president weighing in at this point is going to do, because Republicans have spent the past 7 years talking about repealing Obamacare. Now they're saying repeal and replace. The House left, you know, this baby or this monster on the doorstep of the Senate. The U.S. Senate now has to go back and take care of it and figure out some other process. And I think it's going to be interesting to see whether both houses can come to a compromise. But I'm not surprised that the president is trying to weigh in on this.
Well, let's move on to another story. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was not only in the news this week for his role in the Jim Comey story, he's also issued new guidelines to federal prosecutors across the country today, telling them to pursue the toughest possible charges and sentences against crime suspects. Now, Sessions spoke this morning to the NYPD Sergeants Benevolent Association. Here's a bit of what he said.
Going forward, I have empowered our prosecutors to charge and pursue the most serious offense, as I believe the law requires, most serious, readily provable offense. It means that we're going to meet our responsibility to enforce the law with judgment and fairness. It is simply the right and moral thing to do.
Okay, so here's another point of view. WBUR spoke with Donald Stern today. He served as the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts back in 1993 to 2001, and he had some issues with Sessions' guidelines. Here's what he said.
Well, I think it's a mistake. I mean, this is to some extent a harking back to an earlier regime of enforcement. I think one of the things we've learned, particularly as crime rates have come down, is that we need to afford some discretion to the prosecutors on the front end to make some distinction between very serious violent offenders, which deserve, in many cases, long prison sentences, and those that don't.
So, Jennifer, I'll start with you here. I mean, one of the pieces of the platform that Trump ran on was to be a tough law enforcement president. Is he just doing what he said he would do?
Absolutely. Again, it's, you know, something that Trump ran on, and he's fulfilling his promise. If you are a diehard Trump supporter, you are thrilled with these actions. You're thrilled with health care. You're thrilled with what Sessions is saying. I would say, though, at the end of the day, you know, maybe Sessions needs to come to Massachusetts and talk to the folks over at Mass Inc. and talk about criminal justice reform and see what the statistics really are. Right. In Massachusetts, we're paying over $50,000 per inmate, and they come out and they commit the same offenses again. So, it's interesting to see and to hear about, but I don't know in practicality if it's a very good measure.
Right. Michael Curry, I imagine you would have concerns about the implications of a policy like this in a state like Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked on campaigns against mandatory minimums and really championed this issue as an NAACP around criminal justice reform. I was encouraged over the last 2-3 years when you had Democrats and Republicans starting to understand that mass incarceration is real and it wasn't a good thing, and that there are too many people incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. The concern I have, and actually the interesting thing, is that there's a survey that came out recently that showed that Trump supporters actually want criminal justice reform, too. And they tied it to the opioid crisis, because if you're dealing with the white rural families whose children are now getting caught up in this opioid crisis, they don't want their children to go to jail. They want them to get services and treatment. So maybe there's a way to penetrate this sort of Trump support to really push him and have his supporters hold him accountable to do this smart. Session is dangerous because he would feed mass incarceration, because he has a no-nonsense, high incarceration approach to this work. It's not smart on crime, and that's a concern for all of us.
Well, you mentioned the opioid addiction crisis, and this week the Department of Health announced that opioid deaths in Massachusetts reached a pretty grim milestone. They're projected that more than 2,000 people died of opioid-related overdoses in Massachusetts in 2016 alone. Now, that's a record number, roughly equivalent to 6 people dying in the state every day of opioid-related overdoses. So here's Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutter's talking about these numbers.
The fact that the absolute number would appear to be just over 2,000 in 2016 is a sobering reminder that we still have a lot more work to do to bend the trend of opioid death.
Now, our reporter Martha Biebinger reminded me that there's some good news in this, in that the rate of increase is actually slowing. Still, Jennifer Nasur, these are still pretty sobering numbers, and as Mary Lou Sutter suggested, still lots of work left to do on this.
Absolutely, and I think Governor Baker has been doing an amazing job getting ahead of this and putting together the groups of people that he has put together to research this and to move forward on this and to really try to clean up Massachusetts. And, you know, the secretary is a fabulous example of what he's doing out there.
Speaking of Governor Baker, Michael Curry, President Trump put him on a commission, an opioid, essentially a federal commission to study the opioid addiction crisis nationally. What does that say about the sort of the way Massachusetts is dealing with this and what more Massachusetts needs to do?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to be in a meeting with the governor earlier this week, and it was on a host of issues around health centers and the substance abuse or substance use disorder and what he's doing. He appropriately has the title of the opioid governor, as awkward as that sounds, mm-hmm. and he embraces that. It's because he understands that there's an impact on families, and people need the services, and providers need the tools to be able to treat and save lives. So I think we're in a good position as a state. I think this is another example of us leading and leading from the front and not leading from behind. So I'm excited about the fact that he's placed in that position. And quite frankly, because of the way Massachusetts voted and the positions he's taken on immigration and on Affordable Care Act, we need him to have some wins with this administration, too, so that he has some relationships he can bring back. Some good policy and good success for the state of Massachusetts.
What do you think? I know this is a pretty tough question because this is such a vexing crisis, the opioid addiction crisis. But what more does a state like Massachusetts need to do to sort of further bend that rate of increase in deaths down?
Well, you know, it's funny. It goes back to, I mean, I grew up in Roxbury, right, in an age where people didn't have the tolerance for the crack addiction. And my sister was a crack addict. I remember people treated her like she was a criminal and treated people who in substance use like they were criminals. So I think one is you got to get to the underlying issues that lead to substance use disorder. And I think now, and I hate to say this on a racial sense, but now that more white kids and white families are impacted, now we can have a conversation that will lead to the preemptive prevention services that will save lives and keep people from going down that path. And then you got to put your money where your mouth is. You got to invest in the services that will treat these people when they come into the ERs or a health center or whatever.
All right. Jennifer, sort of final thought for you on where we go in terms of fighting this opioid addiction crisis.
You know, I don't know if it was that it's that more white kids are involved in it. I think the thing is the white communities were just very quiet about it because when it happened, it was your kid is, you know, you're at this upper echelon and that was who got it. And now it's everyone can get it. And so they were able to hide it. I think that it takes families who are involved in it. It takes the schools that are involved in it. It is really a village who needs to be watching our kids and make sure that they're on the right path to success and that they're busy enough. If our young kids are busy and they are involved in sports and they have good friends, chances that they're going to get involved in drugs and get addicted is so much smaller than if we just let them run around the streets and have lots of time available to them.
All right. Finally, I want to leave a little bit of time for our hubbubs, those brief stories that caught our attention but might have fallen below the fold this week. Michael, let me come to you first. What's your hubbub?
Probably the hubbub for me, and I think it's some of the reaction to what happened at the Red Sox, and not the main story, but really the outflow of conversation about where we are as a city. It's created some conversation about Boston's history, but about where we are now. And I think that, to me, that's a long overdue conversation. Is Boston having a conversation with Boston? And I think that the outcome of that will be good.
All right. And, of course, you're talking about the story about 10 days ago or so when fans threw peanuts and hurled racial insults to a Baltimore Orioles player. Yeah, right. A lot of interesting conversation about that. Jennifer Nasur, your hubbub.
Mine is a little bit more on topic for what we were talking about today in incarceration. Mass Inc. came out with a report this week, and they came out with a poll on where people in Massachusetts believe that the criminal justice area should go. And Mass Inc. is having a criminal justice reform summit on Monday morning, and there are over 350 people coming into that. So hopefully they will continue to push out some good information.
Absolutely.
And be able to make some serious impact in Massachusetts.
All right. So here's my hubbub, and it sort of takes us in a slightly different direction. Today, the Social Security Administration released its annual list of the top 1,000 baby names for 2016. Now, for a third year in a row, the most popular female name is Emma, followed by Olivia, Ava, Sophia, and Isabella, which makes me think we're sort of embracing 19th century sounding names. For boys, the top name was Noah for the fourth year in a row, followed by Liam, William, Mason, and James. And the name that dropped in popularity the most for some reason, Caitlin, which fell out of the top 1,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's some
name.
Theories as to why that's happening, but I don't want to get into that. Now, for what it's worth, I put my name into their little calculator. Anthony peaked in 2007 and 2008, when it was the seventh most popular name. In 2006, it had fallen to number 30. Michael, your name had a spectacular run from 1954 to 1998. It was number one.
Wow.
Right?
I didn't
That's
even
44
that.
Years. Today, you're at number eight.
Okay.
Okay. Jennifer, your name was number one from... No, this is good.
This is going to date me.
From 1970 to 1984, today you are 273,
Ooh,
the 273rd
wow.
most popular name.
Yeah,
all right. Anyway, but still a lot better than Caitlin. Okay. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. Michael, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Nasur, a former chairwoman of the Massachusetts Republican Party and of counsel to Rubin and Rudman. Jennifer, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. On Monday, actor Cherry Jones will be the guest of honor at the 35th Annual Elliot Norton Awards presented by the Boston Theater Critics Association. Jones is a two-time winner and five-time Tony Award nominee. Her abiding love is the theater. She's just finished a run of The Glass Menagerie in London. And she began her theatrical career right here as a founding member of the ART in Cambridge back in 1980. So her creative roots run deep in this city. Cherry Jones is also an accomplished TV actor. She portrayed President Allison Taylor in the drama 24, as well as a role in the wonderful Amazon series Transparent, starring Jeffrey Tambor, in which she plays poet Leslie Mackinac. And Cherry Jones joins us now from New York. Welcome to Radio Boston. It's wonderful to at least meet you across the distance between Boston and New York.
I just looked you up, Anthony. I know exactly what you look like.
Well, I know what you look like. I have an advantage because I've seen you act, and it's a great privilege to talk to you.
Ditto.
Well, thank you. I'd love to sort of talk to you about your roots here at the ART. You've done more than 25 ART productions over the years. How does it feel to be honored by the Elliot Norton Awards and coming back to Boston?
Well, any reason to come back to Boston feels like an honor at this point because I've been moving around so much. And the minute that I got the note from Joyce Kilhawick about it, I was so pleased that I was going to get to make a trip up. And it's also Robert Brustein's 90th birthday this weekend and Alvin Epstein's 92nd birthday. For those who love theater in the Boston area, those are two names that you'll probably remember.
Sure. Brustein, of course, the former artistic director at the ART and very much the guy who got you going right there, right?
Well, I was thinking back about how I ended up at ART, and I was the worst auditioner in the world. I mean, just dreadful. And I got an audition for Rosalind and As You Like It. I was 23, and I I knew I'd never get it, but I went just for the experience and to try to get over my nerves with auditioning, which I've never gotten over. And it was for a Romanian director named Andrei Belgrader. And what I didn't know was I was the last person to audition, and it was the last day of the auditions. And I walked in, and I did my little monologue, and when I walked out, the casting director followed me and said, "Can you be in Boston on Friday?"
Wow.
And it was Thursday. So I said, "You mean next Friday?" She said, "No, tomorrow." and so I packed my little suitcase and headed up to Boston with great trepidation, because at the August drama school that I had attended, Carnegie Mellon, we had barely touched on Shakespeare. Oh. I mean, they'd never produced a Shakespeare play the 4 years I was there. I mean, so I remember a friend of mine said, "Cherry, what language do you speak?" And I said, "English." And he said, "What language did Shakespeare speak?" I said, "English." He said, "There you go."
You're all so set. That's all you need to know.
Well, and the great thing is, when I walked into that Loeb at 64 Brattle Street, I was immediately embraced by Karen McDonald and Tommy Darragh and Tony Shalhoub and Harry Murphy and Marianne Owen and Jan and Jeremy Guyte, on and on and on. And stayed there for the better part of really all of the 1980s. And I don't think I would have, I'm really not sure I would have continued as an actor if I hadn't fallen into that company and that group of actors.
Well, I want to ask you about that time and some of the work you did. I mean, speaking of Shakespeare and speaking of the Loeb and the ART, I read this great description in the Boston Globe about one of your roles in 1989, just this morning I was reading this, and it was when you did Viola in Twelfth Night. And this is what I read. Directed by Andrei Serban, it featured a helicopter, a police car, and a scene with Shakespeare writing in a gay bar while Thelonious Monk played the piano. I'm sorry I missed that production.
That was just typical. That was just typical good ART fare in those days. But you know what? It was great, and it worked.
I bet it did.
It really, truly did. Those, I you know, highlighted the most unusual aspects of the production. But Diane Lane was Olivia, the wonderful film actress. She was 24 years old and had grown up at La Mama in New York City, Ellen Stewart's company, and Andre Serban had directed there and directed her when she was 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 years old in the Greek trilogy. So he managed to get Diane to come and be in that production. But it was, they were all just glorious. In the days I was there, we worked a lot with Romanians, three different Romanians in the years I was there.
Interesting.
And the sky's the limit. There are no limits when you work with Romanians. It's heaven.
Cherry Jones, I know that theater is your first and perhaps your greatest love, but I've got to ask you about your role in Transparent, because this is a TV show that I just absolutely adore. And for folks who haven't seen it, I'm just going to say a little bit about it. It stars Jeffrey Tambor, who plays an older father who late in life transitions to female and becomes Maura. You play Leslie Mackinaw, a kind of swaggering lesbian poetry professor who has a relationship with Allie, one of Maura's daughters, played by Gabby Hoffman. And here's a little bit from that, a clip from the show with you and Jeffrey Tambor. Let's listen.
Woman is a dirty word around here. I am a highly placed staff member in the newly named Gender Studies Department.
Right, of course.
Were we at Berkeley together?
Mm-hmm. You edited Perspective on Politics.
I did. Uh-huh. I did for several years.
Yeah.
Yes. Did we publish you?
I applied for the editorial board. And you blocked me. And you took only men. Oh, and one chick who had these huge, huge you couldn't keep your eyes off of, if I remember correctly.
Awkward. That's a great scene. I just love that role you play in that series.
I have to tell you, Anthony, of course, I'm listening to it and going, awkward, because it was my first, it was the first scene I shot.
Is it really?
And,
oh, wow.
And I had watched, because I'm a, I had seen Jeffrey Tambor on stage once in a production of Glengarry Glen Ross several years, many years ago now. And I, he just floored me. I thought he was so incredible. And so when I heard about this show, I never do online streaming stuff that much, but I joined Amazon just so I could see Jeffrey Tambor in this show. And I watched the first season, and I was just gobsmacked. And I turned to my wife, and I said, oh, Sophie, I want to be on something like that.
Mm.
Well, anyway, long story short, when I got the call and I ended up on the show, my first scene was with Maura, and Allie, Gabby Hoffman, and Jeffrey Tambor. And for me, I was just such a huge fan. I felt like I had just suddenly left my living room and suddenly appeared in the land of the Pfeffermans. It was the strangest experience because I loved them. I mean, imagine if suddenly you found yourself in a scene with the Pfeffermans.
Yeah.
I
sort of want to, you know, watching that show. That's sort of a family. I want to go hang out with them. But why did you like the role so much? I mean, why was it easy to say yes to director Jill Soloway when she asked you to do it?
Well, for one thing, I had just played Amanda Wingfield, and it seemed like a nice horse of a different different color.
Right, and we're talking there about the Glass Menagerie, of course.
The Glass Menagerie, yeah. Sorry. And so I thought, and I'd never played a sort of, I think the way Jill described the role to me was she is a dude dyke,
yeah,
were her exact words. And basically I was playing Eileen Miles, the poet, and Eileen and Jill were in a relationship, and I think it was Jill's first relationship with a woman. And Jill Soloway writes very much from her own life, and I just thought, well, there was no way. She could have offered me just about anything, and I would have said yes to work with those people on that show and those writers.
Yeah, and Transparent really pushes a lot of boundaries in how it talks about gender, sexuality. Was that something you wanted to do? I mean, did that excite you, that kind of a program?
Well, there's never been anything like it before, and there's just nothing like being on a pioneer excursion with a group of gifted creative people. And of course, particularly at this time with the trans movement progressing but coming up against tremendous obstacles, I tell you, there is nobody on earth as courageous as a trans man or woman with what they've had to deal with their entire lives to be who they are and want to be.
Mm.
So anything the artistic community can do to make their lives more exciting and better, we'll do it.
Well, actress, actor Cherry Jones, thank you so much for talking to us today. We really, really appreciate it. What a pleasure to
have you. Oh, thank you, Anthony.
That's Cherry Jones. You can see her now in seasons 2 and 3 of the Amazon series Transparent. She'll be in town on Monday as the guest of honor at the 35th annual Elliot Norton Awards. Again, Cherry Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And stay with us. Coming up, we'll speak with a student graduating this weekend who spent 10 years in prison before getting his degree. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is a big weekend for 31-year-old Kyle Gathers. He'll be graduating from the Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology in Boston, and he'll be among those addressing his class. So that's a pretty big deal for anyone. But here's what makes it especially remarkable for Kyle Gathers. He'll be doing this just 1 year after leaving prison. In all, he spent 10 years in prison, including 2 years in solitary confinement for extortion and witness intimidation before he was released last June. While in solitary, Kyle began writing poetry and hopes to publish his book of poems, which he calls Feelings They Couldn't Lock Away. And Kyle Gathers joins us now. Kyle, welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And congratulations on your graduation. How does that feel?
I'm still juggling with the feeling now. I guess I'm kind of numb to it. It's a big surprise. It's a great honor. And I'm just happy to be here and be able to get up there in front of all my fellow students.
And tell us what you've been studying and what you're going to be doing. What's the degree that you got and what's it going to allow you to do?
Well, it was HVAC, so heat and ventilation and air conditioning. That's what I was studying, and it gives me a better chance out in the job force where there's a lot of buildings being built and Boston's evolving a lot. So it gives me a hands-on skill where it's going to make me self-sufficient, whereas I don't have to really go out there and look for a job because I can actually work for myself. So that there gave me a little more ability to do what I want to do for myself if I have to go in business for myself in the future.
Right, and that's important. Kyle, tell me how you ended up in prison in the first place. I mean, we mentioned extortion and witness intimidation. If you don't mind, give us just the sort of quick thumbnail sketch about what landed you there.
What landed me there is that the environment I grew up in, it was always centered around everything negative. All the role models that I had growing up were good role models in their own right, but they was engaged in negative activity. So early on, my biggest challenge was financial security. So at that time, I felt as though anything to be able to get a financial gain up was okay. And I had to wrestle with that idea, and I thought it was okay. And so it led to me selling drugs and being in the drug world. A lot of other negative things come behind that. So you make one choice to say, I need money. Then you go into another choice to say, I'm going to sell drugs to make it. And you don't know that when you do so, you run into so many other dark alleys that come in that.
Yeah.
So I ended up looking out for a friend of mine's and giving him some drugs. And he felt as though he didn't want to pay me back. And I felt as though it was okay for me to take matters in my own hands and go back and inconvenience them by taking things that would have added up to my value on the drugs. And it was silly, it was foolish, and it landed me in prison.
All right. Now, we mentioned 10 years in jail and 2 years in solitary confinement. How does that come about? How did you end up in solitary?
Well, being in there, you still have to be a certain type of an individual in order to get through there.
Yeah.
Being that I went in with some sort of a reputation, being in there, I had to own up to that reputation and still be that in order to get out of there. Although inside, I knew that that didn't define my character or personality, but it was something that I had to do in order to keep up this image to get through. And in doing that, you run into many people inside who, for whatever reasons, they have bad days and you get into arguments, and that's what had happened. And I had a lot of friends with me in there. And we ended up getting into a big like melee or brawl inside there. One individual had got severely hurt, and it was said that I had organized the whole altercation, so therefore the penalty for me was a little harsh than the others, and they sent me to the Department of Detention Unit, which is a separate prison within itself for solitary confinement.
Mm. And what does that mean, solitary? I mean, what does it actually mean? Can you describe what it was like for 2 years?
Well, quiet. You're in a cell by yourself. You come out 1 hour a day. You come out 1 hour a day inside of a little cage that you can just walk back and forth in. You get 3 showers a week. You get 4 phone calls a month after being there 4 months. So you can just imagine that all of the relationships that I had wavered. Everyone went their own way. So I was just left in there, and I had to do that for 2 years.
Jeez.
So,
Kyle, what happened in there? I mean, what kind of thinking did you do? I mean, I guess the question I want to ask is, how did you pull through? Because I think a lot of people being locked up in a cell for 23 hours a day for 2 years might not have fared so well.
Well, of course, a lot of questions go through your head. This is designed to break me. Who am I? What do I really want for myself in life? If I get back to population, what am I going to not do in the future to not ever get here? What can I do that I'm here, and how can I think about myself while I'm here to benefit me when I am released out of here? And that was just out of solitary confinement. So in order to get through that, being in that cell for just 23 hours to yourself, really no other social interaction because everyone else is either trying to sleep their time away or they just don't want to be bothered because they're that mad, I started to write all my feelings down. Hmm. I didn't have enough phone conversations or phone time to share it, so I wrote it down. I sat there, I thought about everything in my life, all the love that I had for others, love that I had for myself, how did I view my surroundings, what actually made me happy while I was there, because a lot of the times, just thinking about my happy times helped me get through. Mm. I had to forget where I was at, and through reading and writing, it made me forget where I was actually at, and it helped me cope.
Now, I understand you started writing poetry in there, right?
Right.
Yeah. Do you want to read one? You've brought one in for us to hear. Tell us what it is.
This one's called Resilient. This one is basically every day when someone sees me, they may not know the pains that I'm going through or how I feel that day. They may just look at the exterior and believe that everything's fine, but still I'm juggling my own demons inside to help me actually exude a better exterior. And to keep strong, because I don't know who's watching me and where their strength comes from. This one's called Resilient. I keep my head high, yet my spirits are low. New troubles to deal with on a daily, with no time to mourn, so it never will show. I smile, even though I hate that I'm here. I refuse to blink first when I stare at that for which tries to fill me with fear. I keep my head high because I don't know who's watching or in who their inspiration lie. I keep my head high chasing my vision, for I'm ambitious and resilient, and know if I stay the course, my spirit will follow. Yet it's hard living inside something so small and hollow without it affecting your mind and spirit tomorrow. Learning to accept the fact that loved ones will come and go during this time is another hard reality to swallow. But I must digest it with a smile, or stress what I can't control, and let reality digest me. I remember when I used to wake up wishing I never woke up, because I enjoyed dreaming I was in another place. Spiritually, I was broken, but my thoughts and memories weren't, which was all I had to help me flip a long face. I keep my head high because I wasn't born to be conquered. I keep my head high because I believe in myself. I believe in my strengths. I believe in my goals. I'm determined. I'm strong. I'm focused. The experiences I dealt with while living in prison still tries to kill my spirit. Yet it's hard to tell, because when they see me, I keep my head high even when my spirits are low. New troubles I face on a daily, with no time to mourn, so it never will show. For mentally, I am too strong to let prison kill my dreams, spirit, or aspirations.
That's Kyle Gathers reading his poem, Resilient. He'll be graduating from the Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology on Saturday after spending 10 years in prison, including two of those in solitary, during which he wrote some of those poems. What are you going to say tomorrow when you address your fellow classmates?
Basically, I'm going to let them know that their work isn't done, that they still inspire other kids that may not be theirs, that still look up to them. Yeah. So basically, it's on them to always exercise their best knowledge of self and exercise their best role modeling of themselves, because they don't know who's watching. And that was the case for me. I watched others who didn't know I was watching them. So basically, I want to let all the students know that they have a responsibility, and their responsibility is to change someone else's life, just as the faculty there, their parents, and all their supporters help get them to this point, that it's on them to role model the best of them so that they can help another child underneath them get to the point that they're at today.
Kyle, have you, and it sounds like you have, but I want to ask this question anyway. I mean, have you come to terms with the crimes that you committed? Do you think about it differently? Do you think about that world differently now?
Yes. Yes. I wrote extensively about, you know, all the pains that I've hurt on others. And I experienced a pain myself before I was released. My brother was killed in Dorchester.
I'm so sorry.
Getting that experience so close to home, knowing that some of my influence while he was watching me as I grew older, and he grew older, that he followed in my footsteps, and it ultimately cost him more than it cost me. So now today, I want to use my influence in a positive way to change another kid's life before he follows in the footsteps of my prior ways.
Well, Kyle Gathers is a student at the Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology. He'll be graduating and speaking to his fellow graduates tomorrow. Kyle, thank you, and again, congratulations.
Thank you.
And finally today, Let's end our show with this. This week, the Boston Pops kicked off its 132nd season with the great singer Queen Latifah. So let's go out on a bit of her performance. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.